And Michael Uslan, who's the author of The Boy Who Loved Batman, he spent much of his young adult life trying to get Hollywood to do the movie which would, in many ways, save Hollywood. They kept saying, nobody wants any more of these superhero movies. We already did Superman. Come on. But in getting involved with the Batman series and then eventually The Dark Knight, you've seen all the different types of movies that this has spawned. The Boy Who Loved Batman. It's his story, but it's also the story of comic books and their impact on the culture. And if you've got Coast Insider, you can go back and listen to the earlier part of the show when we were talking more about that, taking more questions and comments. So phone's locked up. We'll see if we can't get you a line. Oh, wait, it looks like first-time caller line's open suddenly. Grab that now. On Coast to Coast, this is Ian Punnett. All right, so many people hanging on. Let's actually start with Bill in St. Paul on the first-time caller line on Coast to Coast for Michael Uslan. Bill?
Hello, Ian.
Hey.
Hey, great show. Loved listening to it. Thanks for taking my call.
Yeah, thanks for having me.
But question for Mike real quick. You had mentioned Mark Hamill being the voice of Joker. I was wondering, I'm a Star Wars geek, and I was just wondering where he thought how he felt Star Wars fit into the whole comic world, book world, seeing as it's not a traditional comic book, super long lines of Superman, Batman, those type of things.
I think it fits in really closely. Go ahead, Michael.
Yeah, no, I think Bill's absolutely right. It does fit in closely. Whether you go back to the days of Flash Gordon and Buck Rogers, George Lucas, I think, took his love of comics and his love of movie serials, like the old Flash Gordon serial, and combined them into something quite wonderful that was at one moment retro and another moment was very new for other parts of the audience. And, you know, when I bought the rights to Batman, I felt the same thing, that here was something that if we did it this way could be exciting for parents and grandparents as well as kids, but that could be a shared experience where for older people it might be nostalgic and exciting, and for younger people it might be, you know, completely new and exciting. And I think Lucas really tapped it well, and again used core heroes versus villains on a quest. So it all keeps coming back to the basic tenets of folklore too.
Pardon me for not remembering this, but I said that I can't remember whether you said how much you paid for the rights to Batman in 1979.
No, I've never actually said it. Was a lot of money in 1979 dollars. It was a lot of money.
How come you don't reveal that when you reveal so much? And I'm not, you know, I'm not trying to twist your arm here, but there must be a reason why you don't reveal that.
Yeah, it just has to do with business. I wanted to keep away from the business elements of it and really just focus on the fanboy, the creative elements, and keep my emphasis on the comic books and the movies that I love so much. Yeah. But not to turn it into something about how much it made, how much it cost, and things like that, which to me, you know, as I look back over 35 years, is not what's important.
Okay, to you. The rest of us are fascinated by that. I'll just tell you. We're all sitting around wondering how much you paid for it, but here's the question then. By ratio, would you say there's a correlation between buying a comic book for 10 cents that's now worth $52,000 and what you paid for Batman, for the rights to Batman in 1979, and what it ended up making?
A correlation?
Yeah. About the same ratios, 10 cents to 52,000. As to
I really suck at math. Don't ask me any math questions.
All right. Rich is in Trenton, New Jersey, wildcard line on Coast to Coast. Rich?
Hi, Ian. Mr. Uslan, I just have two fast questions. The first one is, did you ever meet or correspond with Bob Kane, the creator of Batman?
Oh, yeah. Bob I knew very, very well. And I also met Bill Finger twice. Bill was, truthfully, I think you have to acknowledge that Bill Finger was a co-creator of Batman along the way. Bob Kane was a great guy. Give you one quick story. At the premiere in 1989 of our first Batman movie, Bob showed up with Stan Lee, and that was it for me. Forget all the stars who were there. I could care less. I got to hang out with Bob Kane and Stan Lee. And the first time some people came up to us to ask us for autographs, it was really the first time I had autographed anything. And all of a sudden, Bob knocks the pen right out of my hand. I go, "What are you doing?" And he said, "You can't just sign your name." He says, "You've got to give them a bat. You got to draw a bat around it." I said, "I don't know how to do that." He goes, "I'm going to show you right now." And he showed me how to do it. I've been doing it ever since.
That's great.
Your second question, Rich?
Well, what I was wondering is, you said you'd like to avoid the business thing and focus on the fun stuff, the fan-ish stuff. But I'm thinking maybe one of the reasons you had so much trouble pitching Batman to the movie studios back in, like, say, 86 and 87 is because Batman has gone through a lot of different changes over the decades, and I can't help thinking he's a lot of different things to a lot of different people. If you asked 100 comic book fans in 1986, what type of Batman do you want to see, you probably would have gotten 100 different answers, because he went from being a really grim, gun-toting guy in the 30s to a sort of more lighthearted guy in the 50s. Then there was Adam West, then there was The Dark Knight by Frank Miller. Do you think that was one of the problems you had pitching the concept?
Not really, Rich. I was dead set on this being the Batman of 1939 as kind of reinvented and modernized in the 70s by Denny O'Neill and Neil Adams and then Steve Englehart and Marshall Rogers. So I was looking for something stylized with a modern-day spin on it, but that really evoked that creature of the night aspect of Batman's personality and visually. So there was no way I was going to move into the camp era or allow them to bring back a funnier version of Batman. It just wasn't in the cards. I was sticking to my guns.
Well, if I hear Rich's question right, I think he makes a point that you wouldn't disagree with, though, and that's that maybe that's why your message about the Batman that you wanted wasn't taking root right away, is that too many other people had other images in their head of what Batman was about. And so while you were pitching the same message, other people were hearing it differently.
Well, that's viable, but I have to set the scene of what was going on in Hollywood at the time. When I started pitching this in 1979, the feeling was that Superman was the only comic book character known enough, strong enough, that could transcend comic books and be made into a blockbuster movie. Nobody was willing to accept that there were other comic book characters, it didn't matter, Batman, whatever version, Spider-Man, anyone else, that could transcend and do that. And that was part of the barriers that had to be broken down working day by day in the trenches out there. They also felt that they believed comic books and superheroes were synonymous. That took some doing to break them of that. And they also felt you needed something, a mighty title, in order to have a successful comic book-based movies, which was proven completely false just a few years later after our Batman, when Men in Black and Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles and The Mask all did incredibly well, even though they never sold more than 5,000 copies of a comic book.
Yeah, that's really interesting about those comic books. I didn't know that till later on. I thought they were huge runaway hits. And then someone told me, no, they weren't huge runaway comic book hits until after the movies came out.
Right.
I didn't
Very
know that.
Obscure.
Tom is in west of the Rockies in Washington on Coast to Coast for Michael Uslan, the boy who loved Batman. Tom?
Yes. I guess that's me.
Yes.
Oh, okay. Hi. I've been a fan of Coast to Coast for years. In fact, in 94, I met Art Bell at his trailer outside of Area 51.
Oh, that's cool.
Nevada. It was quite an experience. But aside from that, I was Cesar Romero's agent.
Wait, really?
The original Joker.
Well, the TV Joker, anyway, yeah. Interesting.
That's right, yeah. And I didn't represent him at that time, but I did 3 years later. And he always used to tell me that you know, of all of his movies he'd done and so forth, he probably got more attention from playing that character than anything else he'd ever done in the public.
Yeah.
And then back about 1977, I was an agent, and a guy walked into my office named Bob Kane, and he was pitching doing Batman as a movie. And my partner, Walter, and I met with Bob, and we talked, and Bob gave me about a dozen wonderful serographs, he autographed of Batman, and I gave them to my kids, and they had them on the walls, used them as dartboards, whatever. We didn't really take it that seriously, to be honest with you. Superman was a big hit, huge. But I didn't think that Batman was a potential movie blockbuster like it became.
Do you feel silly about that in hindsight?
I beg your pardon?
Do you feel silly about that in hindsight?
Oh, yeah. I have a lot of regrets. I turned down The Lord of the Rings, the whole series with The Hobbit. You know, come on. We turned down lots of things, you know.
Well, here's Michael Uslan. Go ahead, Michael. This is Tom. Tom, yeah. Michael.
Hey, Tom.
Hey, Michael.
I'll tell you, I met Cesar Romero and Burgess Meredith and a number of the villains. They were all at the premiere of the 1989 Batman movie.
And, you gotta love it, yeah.
Yeah, you know, it was that night I let the 12-year-old Michael out and was kind of thrilled and loved being around those guys and talking to them. It just helped make it all a very, very special and memorable night. You talk about the things we've all passed on. One of my big regrets, I went to dinner one night with Wes Craven, incredibly talented director, and as I was waiting for him, he said, I just finished writing this script. Just tear it out of my word processor. I'll be out in a little bit. And just tear the holes off the sides and read it. This should be the next movie you and I do together. And I read the script. I said, Wes, this is a terrific script, but it's blood and guts horror. And I don't know, I'm not a big fan of blood and guts horror. I know you're going to sell this, but I don't know that I want to spend the next couple of years of my life doing it. Of course, it was Nightmare on Elm Street.
Yeah.
And I could kick
there you have it. Yeah, that. Well, that's what we did also with the Blues Brothers. You know, Brothers were brought to us. But that was an old comic strip, which had nothing really to do with the movie.
Oh, interesting. I didn't know about that.
It wasn't at all. You know, it was just the title.
Huh.
But we passed on it, along with Dracula. I can't tell you how many.
You're killing me. You're killing me, Tom. I appreciate you jumping in, though. And very interesting about Cesar Romero. Let me move to Harold, who's in Warwick, New York. On the Coast to Coast for Michael Uslan, the boy who loved Batman. Harold?
Hi. Hi, Michael. And,
hey.
It's a great show, and I was just wondering if, while you're reading all these comic books over the years, were you ever able to have a favorite ad in a comic book, so like Charles Dallas?
That's a great question.
Yeah, I spend like the better part of a chapter on this, actually, Harold.
In the book.
As a kid growing up, I wanted superpowers. And if you looked at the ads in the comic books, whether it was the Charles Atlas course, if a bully kicks sand in your face, you know, you can take this course and develop incredible muscles and beat the hell out of them the next week. There were the magic shoe lifts that would make you 2 inches taller instantly. But my favorite one was called X-Ray Specs. And they sold for a buck and a quarter, and you would get them, and supposedly, according to the ad, you could see through girls' clothes. And in seventh grade, that kind of made a lot of sense to me. And I sent away for them, and I waited with bated breath every day for my X-ray specs to appear. I finally got them, and they were plastic glasses that had those Twilight Zone concentric circles twirling in them. And they worked as good as the dollar that I threw away to hopefully pay for my X-ray vision. And it was a very frustrating experience for me at that time. But, I also had, by the way, the Magic Art Reproducer. That was $1.29 or $1.49. And with that, you look through it, and then you look down at the paper through it. You can draw an exact duplicate of the Mona Lisa. That also didn't quite work well for me.
You know, it's interesting about the X-ray specs. You mentioned the outside, you know, with the concentric circles on the outside of the glasses. So that means that while you wear them, the other person knows, theoretically, that you're looking at them with X-ray specs. There's nothing subtle about it. It's like right. you might as well be putting "I'm a big fat pervert" on the glasses on the outside, or "I'm trying to see your underwear" on the glasses, because it was a giant tip-off. So what was the subtlety in that? Let's get to Chris in South Korea. He's on a Skype line in South Korea for the boy who loved Batman, Michael Uslan. Chris?
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
You're on. Go ahead.
Can you hear me?
We hear you great. Go ahead.
Okay, thanks. Hello, Ian and Michael. How are you?
Terrific, Chris. Thanks.
Great. Michael, you spoke earlier of connecting Superman to Moses, for example.
Yeah.
I wanted to hear more about other connections in comics to the well-known heroic archetypes as written about by Joseph Campbell. That kind of thing.
Yeah.
Could you tell more about that?
Yep. We'll put you on hold. Go ahead, Michael, just so we don't get the international phone echo. Because,
sure.
I mean, the Joseph Campbell heroic archetypes are all over the comic book world.
Yeah, you know, as you go back and you look at these types, some are based, they're human. Like, the reason that I loved Batman so much was because he was the first superhero I found who had no superpowers. And I contend his humanity is his greatest superpower. And a guy who can outthink bad guys rather than outslug bad guys. And then you have the alien. You have the ones that come out of science, whether it's Superman or the Hulk. As Stan Lee said, he created that to show a military-industrial complex gone mad. You've got the characters like Spider-Man, who, through a bizarre accident, gain a power, and to whom the power is not a great boon, but it's perceived to be a great curse instead. You have those characters who are empowered by magic, like Captain Marvel. So many different basic types of heroics that are done and different ways that they are empowered that... you know, as you just go down the list of everyone at Marvel and DC, you will see so many of those archetypes emerging one way or another. It's fascinating stuff.
You know, I've always been drawn to the idea that Superman came out of that German concept of the Superman. And so you have the good version, the all-American way version, in Superman, but then you also have the twisted, Hitlerian version of that in the perfect human being the German archetype, the Übermensch. And so they're both the same thing. And one is used by Hitler to create a master race in his mind, and the other was to create one guy who could save us. Which I just thought that's such an interesting duality to that, you know, that and that's where it gets evil, the idea of twisting that into a master race that will dominate all, as opposed to one superhero that will save all.
Right, and you can find that in the X-Men. You can find it even in the Silver Surfer, with a lot more allusions even to Christ, in Silver Surfer.
Yep, nope, that's really, really good. All right, so... I hope that answers the question from Chris, and thank you so much. And we'll get to your questions and comments. We're talking with the man who loved Batman, Michael Uslan. True story of how a comics-obsessed kid conquered Hollywood to bring the Dark Knight to the silver screen. Phones are all locked up, but we'll try and get you an open line coming up next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. I love reading your thoughts, and I love following many of you on Twitter, too, so thanks for getting me as high as I am so far. I'd love to get over 2,000 this week, though, for Twitter followers. So if you like to follow, I promise I don't bug you much. Just a couple of thoughts during the week. You can find Deacon Punnett on Twitter. And I'm looking forward to getting back to your questions and your last couple of thoughts for Michael Uslan, the boy who loved Batman, and the story I wanted to ask him about all night long that we haven't had time to get to. We'll get to next on Coast to Coast. This is Ian Punnett. All right, let's get to as many of you as we can before the top of the hour for Michael Uslan, the boy who loved Batman. Wally is on a wild card line on Coast to Coast. Wally?
Oh, it's great to talk to you, Michael and Ian.
Thank
I just had a comment. Hello?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay, I thought you were breaking it. I just had a comment about the way they portray the Joker. Now, Nicholson and Ledger, they're very magnificent and very intelligent the way they did. They're unbelievable actor. Too bad that Ledger passed, before his time, But what I've seen between these two people, they picked up characters from people they studied. And when I first saw a Ledger Joker, I looked and I said, he portrayed Manson. He had to have looked at clips, like from 60 Minutes. Now, one example is when with Ledger, when he's being interviewed by the police, the same thing with Manson, when he was interviewed by 60 Minutes in a jail, the character in the face, almost identical.
I believe
he had to study them, had to study Manson.
Okay, well, what do you think about that, Michael?
I think it's possible. When you have actors who are getting into a role and looking for inspiration, the sources can come from many, many different places, often just internally, but often they can look elsewhere. So, I don't rule out anything like that. What I loved was what Ian said before about the whole concept of the Joker as anarchist. And the way he was portrayed by Heath Ledger, as I was describing a world that is now order versus chaos, with him representing the chaos aspects of the society, of the world that we live in now. It's one of the reasons that I think that portrayal worked so incredibly well.
I would say that's also the theme of the Bible, is order versus chaos, and that tension exists in every story from the very beginning to the very end. And how much order do we have before we need to have a little chaos? It's kind of like why I always tell young couples before they have a baby, get a dog, in a way. Just introduce a little chaos into your life. Get a puppy or do something, because when that baby comes, that's going to be a super big shock if you haven't had a little chaos in a nicely ordered life. And that's where we always are. We always have to find a little bit of that. But that actually brings you to a question that I just teased and that I was going to wait a little bit, but I'll ask you this. Do you think, as has been so often discussed, that the part that of the Joker really did get in Heath Ledger's head, do you think that it had anything to do eventually why he died?
No, not at all.
Okay. That just got said so much, and to watch the movie, I was taken by. I thought that it seemed consuming the way he did that part.
Let me tell you a quick anecdote.
Okay.
On the set of The Dark Knight, it was a very hot, humid day in July of that particular year, and there were hundreds of extras working on this particular day. And in addition to Heath's makeup and costuming as the Joker, he had to wear a heavy policeman's overcoat on all of it and a policeman's hat with a gun underneath. It was the scene where he attempts to assassinate the mayor.
Right.
And there's a lot of chaos and running back and forth, and it's take two, take three, take four. And then finally there's a break in the action. He comes over to the side. They get the coat off of him. He's drenched. He's just dripping wet, and his makeup is running and still in his Joker costume. And I said, Heath, you've never met my wife Nancy before. She's on the set today. I just wanted to introduce you. Well, for the next 15 minutes, this gentleman wanted to know everything about what my wife was involved in, what she was interested in, about the family, and as if she was the only person in the city of Chicago. That's the kind of gentleman he is, and that's how, you know, with professional actors, they just flip switches on and off.
Yeah, that's very interesting and very sweet, too. And your wife deserves that because she's a saint, because I've read enough of your book to know that. So
she's amazing, yeah.
Let me go to Robert, who's in Biloxi, Mississippi, on Coast to Coast for Michael Uslan, the boy who loved Batman. Robert?
Yes, Michael, I want to thank you for taking my call tonight. Long-time listener, first-time caller. I could remember that the original Batman, The Dark Knight, was also taken from a Camelot story of the Knights of Long Ago, as well as the original black and white movie videos that we used to go see in the movies. And my question is, when you work with Stan Lee with the comics, and that with Batman, The Dark Knight, do you get any say in any of that?
Well, you got a couple things.
How the Black Knight is portrayed.
You got a couple things conflated there, but go ahead, Michael.
Well, you know, one of the things you mentioned, going back to Camelot, that really was used as the inspiration for the creation of what was originally called the Justice Society of America, and today is called the Justice League of America, which was the banding together of all the greatest superheroes ever in one group. And that comes right out of King Arthur's Round Table. There's no question about that. But yeah, you know, along the way, you try to provide whatever input or direction you can, whatever ideas you can. Gets to a point, and I don't want to take anything away. All the credit, all the accolades belong with people like Tim Burton and Anton Furst and Christopher Nolan. Because these are the directors. These are the people who have the vision and have proven they know how to execute the division, the vision that they have. And there comes a point in time where you become the biggest cheerleader in the world, where you sit back and let these people go and create and do what they do and have proven that they do so well. And there's another tip of the hat that needs to be mentioned, because these folks don't get the spotlight. And that is all the people, the artists, the writers, the editors and publishers who have been with Batman week by week, every Wednesday for 72 years, bringing us fanboys back to find out how is this character evolving? What's the next story? Keeping us intrigued. And they really deserve a huge, huge amount of credit that they don't normally get.
I would say there's a lot of great humorous touches to the 1989 Batman, but my favorite moment is when Robert, I can't repeat it, it's what Robert Wool says when he walks away from Bob Kane at the beginning of Batman, right? When he's in the newsroom. And
uh-huh.
I love that joke, and I love that. I love the setup. I love the inside joke of it. I wish I could explain more. First time caller line, Tron is in Morro Bay, California for Michael Uslan. Tron?
Yeah, awesome show tonight, guys. Real quick, Michael, I wanted to know, where do you see the entire realm of just comic books, superheroes, supervillains, just going in general? I know, for example, yeah, penetrating and dominating cinema in general was huge. It was a huge breakthrough, you know, obviously. And where do you see us just going from here? I know, for example,
okay,
like...
let's get that question. I think it's a good, really good question. So where do you see it going?
Well, I'll break it down into two ways, comic books and movies. Comic books... digital is a huge, huge thing taking place right now. And look, we all know print is slowly evaporating under all of us, whether you're in the newspaper business, magazines, or whatever. And it is critically important that the comic book industry move massively into digital. And there are companies out there now, like Graphically, that are creating unique digital experiences that go beyond simply taking a panel or a page of a comic book, digitizing it and putting it on everyone's devices. But through all of these apps and all of these devices, if done properly, comic books will finally get into the hands of millions upon millions of people all around the world who do not have access to a local comic book shop. So that's an interesting, critical, historic turn. In terms of cinema, for me, it keeps coming back to the same thing. It's all about story. Story, story, story. You've got great, colorful characters. Hollywood can't kill they shouldn't kill the golden goose and go out and option every comic book there is simply because it's a comic book. They need to really cherry pick, find the great stories and characters, find the filmmakers who have specific passions for specific characters. And that's, to me, always the best way to go. Example for me this summer, I thought X-Men First Class had a terrific story, and I really enjoyed the movie.
I did, too.
I thought Captain America was so much fun. I hadn't had that kind of fun since the first Iron Man. And I think it really captured something special. And I've told every young person who's enjoyed that movie to go out and find the old movie, The Rocketeer, which is a wonderful movie that never did any business, and it's almost as if you're watching a prequel to Captain America.
Billy Campbell.
Yeah.
Went to high school with him.
Really? Great movie.
Yeah. You know what? Interesting, though, to tell me, ask you about the Greens. Why did Green Hornet, although it did business, it obviously did fine at the box office, I don't think it's particularly good. I mean, it's interesting, got some moments. But why did the Green Lantern fail?
Well, number one, with the Green Hornet, they made a joke out of it.
Yeah.
And fans do not like, they take their superheroes very seriously and the integrity of their superheroes very seriously and don't like their characters to be made fun of. It was kind of more like watching a Peter Sellers Pink Panther movie. Than a superhero movie.
Yeah.
With Green Lantern, it's done good business, so I don't think it can be categorized as just as a failure. But I think part of the problem for me with Green Lantern was the same thing that I had with the Hulk. And the second Bruce Banner turned into the Hulk, it became a giant cartoon for me, a very expensive big cartoon, and it broke that suspension of disbelief that I had. And, you know, sometimes CGI is terrific. Sometimes, to me, it can be defeating.
Interesting. John is in Long Beach, California. Wildcard line for Michael Uslan, the boy who loved Batman. John?
Yeah, thank you. Before I start, you forgot about sea monkeys. I set away for sea monkeys one time.
And how come we haven't had sea monkeys the movie? How come that hasn't
happened? They were a brine shrimp that just, you know. But anyway, I wanted to ask you, you know, we hear cartoons, people getting so involved with them or, into comic books that it sort of ruined their 20s and they got a lot, you know, or some kid got, you know, thought he was Superman, jumped off a building. But have you seen any kind of indication or any kind of proof that maybe, you know, Superman and Batman and all that, just like, you know, Hegel influenced Marx and then Marx influenced revolution, that somebody, you know, in some country that was under siege by the government, you know, was emboldened by these type of things?
That's a great question. A good question.
Well, I'm going to answer it in a very unexpected way. I had an amazing privilege recently to speak at the United Nations with Jerry Robinson, who is the co-creator of The Joker and Robin, the Boy Wonder, and was Bob Kane's first assistant and then ghost artist beginning in 1939. And we spoke to political cartoonists from all over the Middle East and the Far East. And we had an amazing conversation, and it turned out so many of them were Batman fans and were comic book fans and were inspired to go into that profession of being cartoonists and then in their countries becoming political cartoonists who really did believe that they had a responsibility, even though it put their lives in jeopardy in some of their countries, to go out and use this incredible communications tool known as the comic, whether it's a strip, a panel, or a book, to reach the widest possible audience and to educate them and to inspire them. And by doing that and placing themselves in danger doing it, they are potentially making their countries, certainly, and therefore the world, a better place. And I think these are superheroes today in real life who have been inspired by the comic book heroes. And I think that's just one type of way that this manifests itself.
Interesting point. Let's go to Rich in Billings, Montana, on Coast to Coast on a wild card line for Michael Uslan, trying to get in as many as I can before the top of the hour. Rich?
Yeah, I'd just like to say my wife has been listening since she was 11 to old Art Bell, and thanks for that constant entertainment.
Glad to have you. Tell her thanks.
Yeah, good. I just wanted to see, are you, first of all, are you familiar with the old comic and now movie Akira from Japan?
I am not a reader of Akira. I know of it, but I am not a reader of it.
All right. It's like post-World War III, and there's been a demolished Tokyo and the Neo-Tokyo, and they become, as a result of the atomic bomb, they have acquired, like, telekinesis and telekinetic and psychic abilities. And you mentioned before how the World War II had become, like, focused on the good and evil of our culture. I was wondering if you wanted to comment any more on, like, the supernatural powers that the comic books have acquired from that reality of the atomic bomb.
Sort of post-atomic bomb supernatural power phenomenon.
Well, sure. You know, starting in the late 40s, there were characters created like Jerry Robinson's Atom Man that particularly came out of the whole concept of the nuclear bomb. Captain Atom, another one. And then if you move into the era of the Watchmen, Dr. Manhattan. And
really interesting.
You know, so it's carried through, because while the threat ebbs and flows from year to year, it's certainly still out there, and it's still certainly and obviously thematically is on the minds of many of the creators. So I think you're always going to see, same thing with science fiction, you're always going to see that as a source of power, be it for good or for evil, in terms of what the threat of the atom can be and what the benefit of the atom could be.
I will draw your attention to something called Strike Witches. I think you'd really enjoy it. Just if you go to just Google Strike Witches, it's a reimagining of World War II. If there'd been an alien invasion and we all had to band together to fight off an alien invader despite our differences. And this is a Japanese series. And then it gets really weird where women become planes and stuff. But it's really cool. Anyway, well, John's in Lake Arrowhead, California. I'm just trying to squeeze him in here before the top of the hour for Michael Uslan. John?
Yeah, a couple quick questions. Have you played the video game Batman Arkham Asylum?
Yeah.
We mentioned that earlier. Yeah.
Oh, did you? I must not have been listening.
It's okay.
Did you mention how you feel about that game, like how it portrays Batman and the rest of the Batman universe?
I think it's the best comic book and superhero video game ever created. And all the fans I know, fans of Batman, love it. And fans of comics love it. And they can't wait for the sequel games coming. So I think it's really quite extraordinary.
You enjoy it, John?
Oh, I love it. It's actually my favorite video game.
There you go. Very good. Well, let me get in one other thing we got to, because he's been waiting, Kevin. And because the Badgers did so well today against Nebraska, I'm getting Kevin on from Madison,
Wisconsin. Yeah, I
could
really care less about that.
Well, it just got you pushed to the head of the class, so go ahead, Kevin.
Okay, I'm wondering a couple of things. There hasn't been a lot of discussion about the Jack Nicholson Joker, and I'm wondering if there's some kind of, you know, bad politics behind that or something to that effect. Because
I don't know what that means, but go ahead. You want to comment on that, Michael?
About what part of Nicholson's Joker?
The bad politics of the Joker.
The bad politics. I'm not sure what you're referring to specifically there. I know politically one of the interesting things was on Batman and the Dark Knight, following as that movie opened up and became successful, both pundits on the left and on the right were claiming the Dark Knight is theirs. And that was a real kick for me, seeing how the left felt Batman belonged to them, the right felt Batman belonged to them. It's very, very interesting back and forth for a long time.
And the Joker thinks Batman's a fascist. So, yeah, perfect.
Yeah.
The Boy Who Loved Batman, highly recommended book. I don't want to be the lawyer who secured all the rights to all the images in this book. That was like a lifetime of work right there. Thank you so much for your generous time with us tonight. I'm looking forward to continuing this conversation again with you someday. Future success to you, Michael Uslan. Deus te amat, and I do too.